Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Buffalo, New York. He worked for Kodak for 13 years, and then founded and ran Hoover Davis, a manufacturer of automation equipment for circuit board assemblies. After being diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, he became the owner-operator of the True North Country Club in Harbor Springs, Michigan. It's arguably the most beautiful golf course in all of Michigan. His name, John Hoover, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with John Hoover, the owner of True North in Harbor Springs, Michigan, a spectacularly beautiful golf course. John, welcome. An honor to have you.
Well, it's an honor to be with you, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood in Buffalo, New York, and your mom and your dad?
Sure. Well, I was born actually in just outside of Ithaca, New York, and you know when I moved up to Rochester and Buffalo area to work at Kodak when I was 19 after high school. But I graduated from a small high school down there, actually just had our 40th reunion within the last couple of weeks, and it was good seeing some of the people I hadn't seen in 40 years. So, moved up to Rochester to go to work at Kodak as a tool and die apprenticeship, and got started from there.
What was the biggest thing you learned from your mom? And what was the biggest thing you learned from your dad?
Well, from my dad, it was clearly the work ethic. You know, I was around him a lot. You know, he ran several cell phone businesses. You know, we did logging, we did beef cows, did excavating and everything. So saw him work tirelessly and, you know, just did an honest day's work for an honest pay. And but was his own boss and everything, so it was something that even though I was at Kodak, the big machine, the big yellow box as we called it, I always strived to be my own boss and start a business, so I just kept looking for ways to do that. For my mom, you know, I mean, I think it was the honesty and the ethics. She worked at a bank and, I remember one time that she walked all the way back to work because she wound up having like 3 pennies in her pocket that she assumed she mistakenly put in her pocket, and she walked all the way back down to the bank to take that back. And I just remember that when I was probably 5-6 years old. And so, you know, 2 very important things, you know, ethics and work ethics, and work ethic is 2 things that I think were critical to my success.
When you were little, did you invent things or tinker with things?
Yeah, my dad worked on autos, did auto mechanic work at night in the garage, and I'd always be out there with him, helping him get tools and things. And as I grew up, I'd always be over on the side taking things apart and seeing if I could get them back together. And quite often, my dad would have to come to the rescue and help me get them back together. So I don't think I really invented. I was always building things and, that kind of thing, you know, go-karts out of lawnmowers and different things like that, or forts out in the woods. And, I learned by doing and that sort of thing. I learned what didn't work in a lot of cases, so.
You graduate from high school, you go to work for Kodak, an iconic company at that time. And then the whole technology, circuit chips, et cetera, started. Did Kodak embrace the changes, or did they fight the changes?
I would say that they fought the changes. You know, it wasn't union. And so, they always had a good reputation of employee satisfaction. Had a good bonus program and things like that. But, many of us that worked there, when they came out with the disc camera, we all said, why aren't we doing a 35 millimeter? That's where everything's going. And when it came to digital, but their bread and butter was the film business. So, they just hoped, I think they sat there hoping in a dark closet that it would never really evolve to the digital age that it has. And I think most of us there looked at it and said, well, it is coming, So I think they missed a lot of opportunities. They tried to diversify and they got into things that once they took over and added their bureaucracy to these smaller businesses that were high tech, they just weren't successful.
You went to work there in 71. In 83, you have a review with a boss. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, as I mentioned, I only had a high school education and never went to college. So, I was managing the electronics assembly area at the time, and I had worked in engineering department and that sort of thing as I worked my way up the ladder. But they basically had told me that because I had no degree and that I hadn't demonstrated a good sense of business to them in their eyes anyway, that I'd gone as far as I would go, and I should be pretty happy that I'd made it to a manager position, and that was probably my plight. So I felt that I disagreed with that. And I had taken them a couple of business opportunities, and actually I'd taken them Hoover Davis, what wound up to be Hoover Davis, as an opportunity, and promoted it to the upper echelon of management. And they basically said it wasn't something that they wanted to get into or invest in and develop. So, they just told me thanks for the opportunity, but no thanks.
Did you ever run into that boss again, John Hoover?
Yeah, I did. Actually, probably about 10 years into Hoover Davis, I got a call from him, and he wanted to come in and talk with me, and I wasn't sure what it was about, but as it turns out, they had let him go in the downsizing, and Kodak went through a tremendous downsizing over the years after I had left, and it was just starting when I left. So he'd come in and was looking for a job, and as a matter of fact, I still had the review that he had written up over my desk, and I didn't throw it in his face or anything. I just sort of glanced at that and told him I didn't really feel that I had some position for him. So and we parted ways after that. So
we're talking to John Hoover, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're with John Hoover, who founded Hoover Davis in 1984, a manufacturer of automation equipment for circuit board assemblies. John, a lot of people today are being told they can't do something, whether they're a young person or whether they've been with a company 30, 40 years. What do you say to people who are told over and over they can't do something?
Well, I think that if you've got the confidence in yourself and you have to look deeply into the opportunity, my son recently just came to me and wanted to get, some funds out of his trust fund to do some, get into a business with another guy. And, so I'm trying to help him sort through that. But, and I'd love nothing better than to see him be his own boss and be involved at that level and, take the risk reward with the opportunity to be successful. But, it's a real decision. I mean, I had two young children at the time when I left Kodak, and my father reprimanded me saying, you got to be crazy. You're leaving a company like Kodak. And he grew up in the IBM era. He'd never worked there, but down in Ithaca where I grew up, IBM was very big in the Binghamton and Johnson City area in Owego, New York. And IBM was the chief, much like Kodak in the Rochester area. So, you know, he reprimanded me, said, you have young children, he can't leave a big company like that. You've been there for 12, 15 years, you know. But the minute I did make the decision to leave, he was right there to help me, you know. So he didn't, you know, he knows how he struggled and everything. So he wanted the best for me and my family and everything. But it was just something that I felt that I had to do. And I had the confidence and had a few people that believed in what I was doing and were going to help out financially and that sort of thing. And Kodak gave a severance package that I got paid for a year to leave. So I felt that, you know, I had 1 year to work my butt off and really do my best to get the company making some money, and we were able to do that. So, but I really encourage, and I still talk to a lot of people. I don't do too much investing in that sort of thing anymore, but I certainly get calls from, you know, legal counsel that I'd worked with in the past wanting to know if I would talk to somebody that they're working with now that's looking at starting a business, and just, you know, just making sure that they understand the difficulties, that it's not, you know, you're going to scrimp and save. You got to cut costs where you can in the beginning to make it a success in most cases. You know, there's software where there's not much development costs. With your background, you know, the development of the software there is, but there's not a manufacturing cost. You know, in the golf course, there's set overhead, you know, so there's all kinds of businesses, and you got to understand how they work and what the tax ramifications are. And in these days, with the tax ramifications and what they're talking about doing, you know, tax-wise, boy, I don't know, the risk-reward, if they don't do something about rewarding those that start businesses and employ people on a longer-term basis, then, you know, they're just not going to be people doing it if there's not a reward at the end. Why would you take all that risk if you're not going to be set with the rewards?
You start Hoover Davis in 84. What year did you go to China, and why did you go to China?
Well, as far as going to China to sell, we did that early on. It was in like 92 the first time I went, and it was difficult to get into China. And there wasn't a lot of business there, but it was more in Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia a little bit. But then as things started opening up in China, I realized quickly that, you know, we were going to have to be able to manufacture there, because just the import taxes and everything, it's not a level playing field over there. So I knew that we were going to have to get in there and start manufacturing there. So that was in 99, we started doing our first just some assembly work there, and then went on to make parts there and set up a manufacturing site in Shenzhen. Right across from Hong Kong. So,
what were the one or two most amazing things you saw in China?
I just think that, you know, seeing the conditions and everything, and over the years, how much those conditions have changed, you know, the wealthy, you know, it was either wealthy or you were dirt poor. And so there was an awful lot of diversity now in how the people live and everything. But I think just seeing how they could throw three inspectors, if you would call them inspectors, I guess, untrained people, but to check the work of another one because the labor costs were so inexpensive, that I think that was, and realizing that young ladies and guys would come from their country villages and come into the confines of the city of Shanghai or Shenzhen or Suzhou and work there for 3 years and go home with a diary, you know. And that was probably after 3 years work in food and board. You know, that was probably a few thousand dollars, but that was enough to, you know. So just realizing the labor rates there and that they didn't have OSHA and other things there to protect them, that, you know, it was going to be a force to be reckoned with, and it has been.
Talk to us, John Hoover, about the future of manufacturing in America.
Well, I have several good friends in the parts manufacturing industry, and And some of them are doing very well because they're doing things that are real high tech, or they're going after the market where it's very, you know, protected through patents and intellectual property. In those kinds of categories, I think that there will always be, you know, the opportunity here in the United States. But I think that the low labor, putting in screws, doing that kind of labor is, you know, it's not coming back. you know, it just isn't coming back. So, you know, we have to, you know, protect our intellectual property and protect that side of the business where it's high tech, high precision, unique applications, whether it's process or procedure, and protect those things. But the government's got to help with, you know, the issue of protecting them on the taxes.
It's 2003. You have 600 employees, 350 in America, and you sell Hoover Davis. Why, John?
Well, part of it was the Parkinson's, you know, knowing that, you know, that was going to have an effect on my life, and it certainly has. Do the best I can with it, but, you know, it's been a negative thing in my life. But, you know, I just felt that it was at the time, some of my partners in the business felt that it was time to cash in, and you know, it was the Dover Corporation that I sold to was a great company or conglomerate of companies. And, you know, they made certain commitments to me about keeping the company in Rochester and all that sort of thing. So it was time. You know, I was 52, 53, and, you know, with the onset of Parkinson's and everything, I just knew I wasn't going to be able to keep up the international travel the way I had. And if I couldn't do the job right, I didn't want the job. So
we're talking to John Hoover. And when we come back, we'll talk to him about arguably the most beautiful golf course in all of Michigan, True North. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Now, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with John Hoover. And last year, Golf Digest ranked True North the number 8 golf course in Michigan and the number 4 public course in all of Michigan. In my humble opinion, I think it's the most beautiful course I've ever been on in my life. The scenery, nature. John Hoover, it's spiritual, whether you're in the fairway or in the woods. Tell us about your golf course.
Well, it's designed by Jim Ang, who was Golf Course Architect of the Year in 2003, the year that True North was built. He had a great piece of property. It's in the hardwoods of northern Michigan. We're 5 miles roughly from Lake Michigan and about 20 miles from Lake Huron and I think around 55 miles from Lake Superior. So you know, we're right at the tip of the mid, as they say, up here. And, you know, it's just a beautiful countryside, and he did a spectacular job of using the natural transition of the terrain and the hillsides and carved it out of the woods. And it's just a beautiful piece of property, and we've done what we could to, you know, through landscaping and that sort of thing to, you know, improve upon that and enhance that, the feeling when you come into the parking area as well as the whole golf course. We have a great superintendent who does just a miraculous job of conditioning the course, and he's out there, works tirelessly every day through the summer to make sure we have the best product possible. And to be very honest, it's very seldom that somebody comes off of this course that doesn't go out of their way to come in and mention to us just how breathtaking and beautiful the course is. You know, the topographical changes and elevation and that sort of thing are significant. And, you know, and you need to play the course a couple of times to really appreciate every aspect of it. You know, there's areas that look pretty narrow, and then when you get out into the fairway, you realize that they open up right where they should open up, where your ball's going to land, and that sort of thing. I know it came up a few times when we were playing the back yesterday, or the other day.
You lived your whole life in Upper New York, and in 2006, you become the owner of this course. And basically, you've spent the vast majority of your time in Michigan since. Why did you do that?
Well, I, we talked about investing earlier. I had the course got, while it was being constructed, it fell into the bank, backed out of the deal, and the construction company had walked off. So I was in, had a connection to the people doing the project, and wound up coming up and seeing where they were and everything. And with me and a friend of mine, we came in and helped finance the completion of the construction and everything. And it was supposed to be just a, you know, a financial venture to help the company and help get the project completed, you know, with the understanding that we were going to get paid back in a year, and things just didn't work out. You know, the golf industry tapered off. I think that the economic changes, everybody felt in their pocketbooks in that 04, 05 time frame, everybody was tightening the belt. And even in the Harbor Springs area, where it's a very affluent area, in the summer especially, the summer people that come up here for their summer vacations are, there's a lot of affluence there, and but they started looking at their trust funds and whatever, and took a second look at what they were doing, and memberships dried up, and you know, the housing never took off, and so it was a struggle, and then when things weren't improving, we had to make a decision, and our decision was to come in, and we took the property over deed in lieu of foreclosure, and I just felt that I had retired from Hoover Davis, and mostly because of the, you know, as we spoke before, of the not wanting to travel the way I had been traveling. So I sort of set anchor here and just fell in love with the area and the people and the golf course especially.
If you want to learn more, www.truenorthgolf.com. Truenorthgolf.com. This is not a paid endorsement, but I could play that course every day for the rest of my life. It's spiritual. It's spiritual. When Mike and I came there last Sunday and played with you, or were scheduled to play with you, they found you mowing the fairways.
Well, I was mowing one of the building sites in the subdivision. We had some people coming to look at the property and everything, and sort of ran out of time during the week, and they were coming over Sunday afternoon, so I went and jumped on a mower. But I grew up running a bulldozer and tractor and everything else when I was a little kid, back with my grandfather on the farm and my dad and everything. So, you know, I'm not estranged to it, and gives me a chance to go out and smoke a cigar and do some physical labor once in a while.
Now, you're currently building two golf cottages, four bedrooms each, that are going to be ready for spring. Talk about that, if you will.
Well, it's, you know, our goal and our vision here is to have this become a destination golf course, and we're getting people. We quite often pick people up at the airport that fly in on their private planes and that sort of thing, that come up here from other parts of Michigan and coming across from Chicago and as far away as Columbus, Ohio now. We want to start promoting and advertising, you know, outside the area. We have several members from the Dallas and Houston area of Texas, and some from Florida and that sort of thing. So the devastating heat that they get down there and the humidity. I mean, today was just a perfect day. It was 75, 80 degrees, a light breeze, pretty much full sun, little or no humidity. Didn't even break a sweat when I was out playing today. So it's just such beautiful weather up here that, you know, but one of the things that we kept hearing and have been hearing even this year is that we need accommodations, that they don't want to come and stay at a hotel 5-10 miles away. They want to stay here at the club. And we have one house that we've been renting out, but That's just a regular house. So we're building two golf cottages to start with plans and the sub-development to build 12 of them ultimately. There'll be four bedroom, you know, each bedroom has its own bath and set up for two single beds that can be made into a king-size bed so you can accommodate, you know, the typical numbers, you know, 4, 8, 12 guests and per each, you know, with screened-in porch and limited accommodations as far as cooking capabilities, but, you know, we want to have them use our restaurant and everything that's doing very well this year. And so we're excited about it. We're just going through the process with the county to get the planned unit development program through and approved, and that should be taken care of within the next week or so. And then we'll, you know, hopefully break ground on the cottages here shortly and then be working on them inside through the winter and have them ready for, you know, the May time frame of the 2011 season.
John Hofer, what does golf teach us about life?
Well, the way I played today, well, I think, you know, the whole thing of, you know, that you can learn a lot from somebody playing golf with them, you know, if they take the lie the way it is. And, you know, I mean, it can be a tough day, you know, the wind can come up and, you know, it changes the whole play of the course and everything. So I think that it just teaches you that, you know, and it teaches you a lesson if you're not able to do it much, you know, to golf and get out and practice and that sort of thing, because, you know, this is a game of that can be very frustrating if you are having a bad day at it. And unless you golf a lot, those days are more and more frequent.
We're talking to John Hofer. When we come back, we'll ask him about being diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2002. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with John Hofer, the owner of True North Golf Club in Harbor Springs, which is the only Silver Sanctuary golf course in all of Michigan. John, let's go back to 2002, and you're diagnosed with Parkinson's. Talk to us about Parkinson's disease.
Well, you know, it's, I woke up one morning and, much like in the Michael J. Fox book, you know, I realized I was sitting there looking at my hand tremoring a little bit and wondering if I had, you know, had too much to drink or whatever it may have been, you know, to cause it, but it was just sort of strange thing. And then, you know, it went away, so I didn't think much of it, and then it would reoccur. And, you know, there had never been, you know, Parkinson's isn't hereditary. So, you know, it wasn't something that I even considered. And as things progressed and I started getting the tremors more pronounced, I did seek medical help. And you know, they had diagnosed me, at least preliminarily, with Parkinson's and said, you know, it could be just a movement disorder. And I was involved with a couple other businesses that did CAT scans and PET CTs and that sort of thing. So I did an L-DOPA brain scan, had one done out in Las Vegas at one of our sites. And they confirmed that I had about a 10% deficit of dopamine in the right side of my or left side of my brain, which was gave me the tremors on the right side. So, you know, it was a matter of dealing with that, and, you know, it didn't have that much effect on my life in the earlier stages. But I went the pharmaceutical route when it first was diagnosed, and, you know, I just found that the side effects of the pharmaceuticals were actually, in my eyes, worse than the disease itself or the effects of the disease. And so I dropped out of the pharmaceutical approach to treatment, which was just trying to cover things up, basically. it wasn't anything that was going to really cure, help, or stop, or slow down. So I've gone to a pretty natural approach of heavy vitamin D, vitamin B and C, and coenzyme CoQ10 and pharmaceutical fish oil and those types of things. And, you know, I think that it's been the progression has been slower than many of the people that I know that were diagnosed around the same time in some of the support groups that I've met. And, you know, I think that my condition has not progressed as rapidly. But everyone's different. So, but it was a change in my life. And I grew up with somebody, a good friend of mine in high school. Her father had Parkinson's, and I saw him deteriorate to a pretty significant, you know, where he was unable to feed himself or anything else. And, you know, I mean, I'm far from that. I'm still playing golf, not very well, but it's not the Parkinson's fault. And, you know, I'm just trying to deal with the emotional side of it. You know, my kids are, you know, feel bad that this is after all the hard work and everything, that it's a time for me to relax maybe and take it easy. And I don't know if that's what I really want to do necessarily, is stop working, but they just feel bad to see me with the condition and that sort of thing. And it only really flares up if I'm aggravated or emotionally distressed and or that sort of thing. But try to deal with it in a positive way, and, you know, just try to stay in shape and stretch and do the things that fight off the side effects of Parkinson's.
What would you say to a listener tonight who's the loved one of somebody that's just been diagnosed with Parkinson's?
Well, you know, I mean, trying to learn, a lot of people don't understand about the emotional side effects and that sort of thing that are part of Parkinson's. So I would say try to learn. There's just a tremendous amount of information out there in the world today, you know, with the internet and everything that talks about that. You know, Michael J. Fox has written a couple of great books. There's, you know, Muhammad Ali, you know, Janet Reno. They've both done some writings and things. And Parkinson's can affect you in many ways. And so trying to understand, you know, how you can help them, you know, depending on what aspect of the disease you're getting. Now, I haven't had the freeze-ups or anything, which is predominant in a lot of people, where you just sort of freeze your movements. Mine have been predominantly just tremors, a little shuffling and dragging of my right leg, but mine's been pretty much confined to the right side. But I think that just being educated and understanding that there's more than just the outwardly physical aspects of the disease to be considered, that there's an emotional battle going on. In Michael J. Fox's first book, he talked a great deal about how he wanted to be alone. You know, he had young children and everything, and a loving wife, and I had the same thing. And, you know, it was difficult because at times I just wanted to be alone. And, you know, that's part of the disease. So I think just being educated as to the different aspects of the disease and being supportive is, you know, there's not much more that you can do.
John Hofer, what does a Michigan golf owner-operator do in the winter?
Well, you get ready for the next summer. You know, up here we're plowing snow and everything, which is the, you know, to keep the roads open. But we start in January. You know, you're finishing up the year in December, and then you start doing your Christmas sales stuff and specials on the internet and that kind of thing, setting those things up. And then you go to the PGA show in Orlando the last weekend in January, and then we do the Novi show and the London, Ontario show, and we do two shows in Chicago, and we're looking at doing Columbus, Ohio this year, but Grand Rapids. So there's pretty much every weekend you have 3-day shows, Friday afternoon, Saturday, and Sunday. So you leave on Thursday and you get back on Monday, or maybe on Sunday night. And so there's, you know, that takes you through February and March and even into April. And we opened up on April 1st this year. So in 80-degree weather, which was a rarity for up here, but it was what we had this year. So we did open about 3 weeks earlier. So, You know, there's really, December is probably the quietest month that you have because you really haven't started cranking into the new year yet, but yet you're pretty well finished with the previous season. So there's a lot going on. You have your marketing and advertising and, you know, trying to put, you know, deals together for memberships and, you know, all these things, you know, that is taking an awful lot of time, and you got to look at the competition and what other people are offering, and that changes every year. So there's a lot going down in the winter.
When you're on that course, you know, that second hole where you're looking down, or I think it's six when you've got that par five looking down, it's almost spiritual out there. Do you ever talk to God when you're on that course?
Well, there's a couple of places that, you know, because of the conservancy property around us, it is very quiet. I had a friend here from Asia, and he stood on the fourth tee box and said, "This is a power point in the universe because you can hear silence." And so I do, you know, I mean, I don't know that I can say that I speak to him that much, but, you know, I feel like he's present out there more than most places. You know, you don't hear the cars driving by, you know, you don't hear much of the planes, and there's no trains and trucks and everything else. So with that silence you have out there, you certainly feel that you're at peace with them.
Last question, John Hofer. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
Well, work hard, be ethical, help people, treat people as you would want to be treated yourself. And I think those are the important things in life, that, you know, you have to live your life, you know, the right way and treat other people the way you would want to be treated yourself. So, and take chances. Work hard and take chances. Make them good chances. But I think that's what I hope my kids do.
Well, John Hofer, thanks for taking a chance on Michigan, Harbor Springs. You've brought great joy and heartache. Every golf course brings heartache as well. Keep up the great, great work, and thanks to you very much, Jack. Our guest next Sunday will be Mike Wayne, the founder of Dynamic Rehabilitation. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.